and welcome back to the Palace Way podcast. It is one of the better days to be a Crystal Palace fan, or one of the better weeks in total, if you think about it, with a 4-1 win over Villa, a 2-0 away win against Fulham. And today I'm joined by, as always, Pat. How are you doing?
Doing great, doing well. It's always a lot more fun to record these when the team is playing the way they are. So I look forward to talking about Palace with you guys.
And of course, Bobby Manzi back again. How are you doing, Bobby?
Yeah, I'm very well, thank you. Busy week. I think I've spoken to Oliver Gazza more time than I have my own family. But other than that, it's pretty good.
Possibly the least subtle flex you've done on this podcast thus far, and that's truly
I don't think it was a flex. It's more the fact that we've just had to, well, we're going to, by the end of the Millwall game, have had 6 press conferences with him in 8 days.
Let's get straight into Fulham. We'll move on to Villa later on and then do a bit of a preview on Millwall as well. I think it's safe to say Fulham haven't been an easy team for us to play recently. That 2-0 defeat in the winter was pretty brutal. I was there, and watching us choke another home game was depressing, but it couldn't be further from that reality on Saturday. I thought Will Hughes was exceptional. Bobby, is there anything you want to add on that you thought was significant about the game?
Yeah, I think after the Everton game, maybe the outlook was quite morbid and bleak on some forums and channels you read or Twitter. I think people were quite upset with that defeat. But then the discourse just shifted at Fulham. I thought the game was probably the complete opposite in every sense, the reverse fixture. It was controlled, dominant, slick. And it was really a perfect away performance, another 2-0 win away from home. That's 4 in a row now. Will Hughes, as you mentioned, absolutely brilliant. It was a great corner delivery for the one that Anderson nodded into the back of his own net. Tyrick Mitchell, another player who stood out for me. I think in a team performance like that, it's always difficult to single out individuals because everyone played so well. But I think you've got to give Tyrick Mitchell his credit. He brushed aside his Blunderson performance against Everton, kept Traore quiet, was pretty comfortable with the ball. I thought he played really well. Daniel Munoz, magical. What a finish for that second goal. Just tight angle and smashed it into the back of the net. It was quite remarkable. It was great work from JP too, to play him through the dribbling, beating two players in midfield. I was really impressed with that. After the game, I asked Gasner about his targets for the season because it felt like it could be a real turning point. Fulham, yes, they have inconsistent results at times, but they're a pretty stable side, European hopefuls, and it felt like a really big win for Palace. And he said that his side are now playing Crystal Palace football. He feels like he's got the identity that was maybe missing in the first 8 games of the season. Palace are back to their best, maybe starting to reach the peak of their season. He didn't want to put a figure on a target of points. It was taking one game at a time. But I think there's a real sense around the club at the minute that Palace can still achieve some kind of success this season, whether that's trying to break into that pack just above us that are chasing for Europe, or maybe going deep in the FA Cup. But yeah, I was really impressed at Fulham. I thought it was an absolutely dominant display, and it was really, really impressive.
Yeah, if I can add on to that, I think the Palace style that Glasner's discussing about getting our kind of groove back, it really has to do with two things to me. It's defensive organization or out-of-possession organization, and also the physicality aspect of it. I mean, you look at Fulham this season, and they've really hung their hat on being a very physical club, a very physical side, and tough to win duels against and things like that. And the impressive thing about that match was that Palace seemed to dominate them physically. They took a very physical team and kind of put it to them in that aspect. And one thing that is really true for, Lord knows, probably all of 2025 is just the organization out of possession. You can really see the shape. You can really see the players communicating with each other. And you can really see how that's limited chances, you know, both in the data and both in the eye test. And I think those are the things that when we talk about starting to play in the Palace way, wink, wink, that's the way that we want to see, is physical and organized in the way that we're set up.
I totally agree with you, Pat. And I think to limit a side like Fulham to no shots on target in the game, it just showed you how organized Palace were, how disciplined they were in defending. I thought it was really impressive. But what I was also pleased with was their free-flowing attacking football. Maybe a criticism you could have lodged upon Palace this season is that they've created good chances and haven't taken them. But against Fulham, they did that. Yes, they missed a few chances, but they took enough chances to win the game. I think it was a super convincing performance. I spoke to Bruno pretty much straight after the game, and I said to him that I felt like it was the most complete performance we'd seen from Palace this season. I think all over the pitch, Palace were just better. It was superiority in its finest, and it was a very, very good away day for the Eagles.
I just want to go back to that Munoz goal because obviously it's great work from Mateta in the build-up, but it looked almost in slow motion. And I was wondering what you think the trade-off is between a good piece of skill from Munoz to dummy the cross before shifting it onto his right, or if it's just Calvin Bassey who's completely lost his head, because I've never seen a defender get sent and leave a player with that much space in a penalty area before.
Well, Munoz initially cut back, didn't he? Because he looked for the cross, saw no one was there, and just quickly shifted the ball. And I think where Bassey had already adjusted his body to try and deal with the cross, that he couldn't then readjust again. I think it was all too quick for him. And I just think it was a brilliant bit of skill from Munoz. Yes, maybe Bassey could have done better. I think it's a difficult one to judge, really. I'd give him the benefit of the doubt if I was on the Fulham side and say that probably he didn't have time to readjust himself. But I think we should just look at the brilliance from Daniel Munoz, the confidence that he had to just take that shot on from such a tight angle. I mean, the chances of scoring was pretty low, and he just made it look easy.
It was Martin Kelly-esque, what I'd say if anyone remembers the away fixture in the FA Cup against Spurs. But as we're working backwards through the goals, the first one, a Joachim Andersen own goal, he was kind of the pantomime villain of the night. Not that I think he has any reason to be beyond just being a former Palace player. I think there wasn't anything too unworldly about his exit, but our social media strategy seemed to maybe paint him as more of a villain than he otherwise should be.
Yeah, he didn't make it easy on himself with the standoff that happened between him and Eze, and also that kind of pushing and playing between him and Mateta before that goal. And I don't know if the cameras were different, what the streaming was over there, but over here in the States, they clearly showed the referee kind of giving a stern warning to both Mateta and Anderson, walked away, and then Mateta came back and just gave him a nice little shove. So, I think he got under his skin a little bit, which is something that we saw Joa do so well when he was with us. You look at that Liverpool match at Anfield when he famously got Darwin Núñez, excuse me, to get a red card and kind of see red in that scenario. So kind of a little bit of a flip. I think it's all in good fun. I mean, you can say what you want about Anderson. I think he has some things that people could find fault with when he was at Palace, but overall, I think the players liked him, and the crowd liked him, the fans liked him. So I think it was more good fun. But yeah, with those two incidents, he didn't do himself any favors.
Yeah, I mean, I see it almost as a sign of respect the way that Eze wanted that Mexican standoff with him, and Anderson obviously played into it with the little Mateta gesture to tap on his wrist as if to say Eze was time wasting. I actually thought it was a Lacroix goal, the own goal at first, and I was almost sad to see that it went down as an own goal, just not just out of empathy for Joao, because of the story of Lacroix beating Anderson in the air to put Palace in front against Fulham was pretty good after all the discourse earlier in the season about Lacroix. And he's someone I actually want to touch on because I think he's been exceptional these last couple of games in particular. We are very dependent on that back three. They've been rock solid for the majority of the season. We haven't let in too many goals, even if some of them have been down to errors. The majority of those haven't been errors from the centre backs, and all three deserve the credit, but Lacroix especially recently has sort of come in and taken it to a new level. Because he was maybe a bit of a passenger at the start of, certainly at the start of the calendar year, and he's just gotten better and better.
His communication is so big. We needed a leader back there, and he's really stepped up in that regard. And what we're seeing now with him and Richards is we're seeing Richards stay back almost as a true right-sided central defender, even when we have possession. When we had Chalobah, we saw Chalobah shifting out to play right back and form a pseudo back four because Mitchell would stay a little deeper. That was a little bit problematic in a couple ways, with advantageous in the fact that it was aggressive. It did get us forward, but created some problems in the sense that it did create some bigger channels for opponents to hit a counterattack through. And it also, if you look this year at Mark Gahey, I think we can all agree one of his better qualities is his ball carrying ability from the back line. His carrying numbers, both in terms of overall carries and in terms of progressive carrying yards, is the lowest they've been since he joined Crystal Palace. A lot of that was because we're in that pseudo back four. When you're in a back five and you lose one player to form a back four, you're not going to have another central defender step up. You're not going to have a back five turn into a back three when it's not the wing backs. So he was kind of limited in his ability to get forward. What we see now with Richards kind of staying back is not only does it shut down those channels and kind of close those off and make them harder to attack through, but it also gives Gehi the ability to step into midfield a bit more. And against these last two opponents, I'm calling Fulham a two-man midfield because Emile Smith Rowe was playing as an out-and-out 10. He was the fourth attacker. He contested zero duels. I think he attempted one or zero tackle. So I'm saying it was a double pivot. And against Villa in that match also, you saw two-man midfields that Gehi was able to step in, create a numerical advantage, and was able to help us to get those attacks and create a little more high-flying football. So just a little tweak, a little tactical tweak, a nuance that Glasner's had since we've had Chalobah leave and Richards come on. And if you don't want to look at it from a tactical aspect, Palace have allowed the least goals per match since Richards came on, since Chalobah went to Chelsea. So whether it's theoretical or whether it's, you know, the actual data, that looking at goals allowed, we've seen a marked improvement in the year 2025 under Palace.
That's a kind of an interesting stat, because I thought we actually looked quite defensively ropey yesterday. At times, especially in the first half, obviously, they put the ball in the back of the net three times in total in the game. Two were disallowed due to offside, one blatant, one very much less so. And I felt like we were getting exploited down that right side of our defence due to Munoz committing so high up the pitch and Richards ending up isolated in 1v1s. And I think actually of those two players, Richards and Lacroix, who've been so good, they were probably not fully switched on for the goal. Because they went route one, Morgan Rodgers just took it down and everyone looked lost. I think it's probably a case of the system's working better. And everyone has on days and off days. But they're getting punished less because of the strength of the system, everyone gelling, morale being better. Like, a home win does wonders for our season. It breaks a kind of mental block that we've had since, what, Southampton? So it's a good sign of things to come. I'm optimistic in what we've got. Ipswich, Southampton and Millwall in our next three games. Bobby, is that right?
Yes, mate. Yes, it is.
Yeah, so three massive games for our season. I think all three of those can be described as must win.
Brighton straight after as well.
Right, and if I may step in with this one, we look at where we are on the table right now. I believe we're 7 points behind Brighton. And we have two what I would consider must-win matches against two relegation fodder teams in Southampton and Ipswich. And then we go into Brighton at home. Before Brighton plays us, they have to play, I believe it is Fulham, City, and Villa. Villa and Fulham are at home, City is away. And then they come in to play at us. So there's a strong possibility that we gain some points on them before they come to Selhurst Park. And then it's a 6-pointer. And, you know, I'm not trying to wax poetically, because we do have a lot of work cut out for us, but we are playing well. And we do know that overwhelming chances that eighth place is going to get a Conference League bid this year. That game against Brighton, not only is it a rivalry, not only is it going to be, you know, huge from that aspect, but it's a 6-pointer for Europa, or not Europa, Conference League contention. And I think that's great talking about, because if we were here in October talking about that, we'd probably get laughed off of this podcast.
I'm so apprehensive about that. I would love to see us challenge for Europe, but it scares me. But I guess one thing I wanted to mention about those next two games in the league against Ipswich and Southampton is we're going to be Will Hughes-less due to the yellow card suspension he picked up through accumulation in the game against Villa. So most likely, I guess, we see Lerma and Wharton. But thankfully, he'll be back for Brighton. But it's a bit of a squad weakening issue.
I think I just want to pick up on what Pat said about Europe. I do find it an interesting point. I don't think it's inconceivable. I think it's unlikely, but I don't think it's impossible. I think the one thing that Palace have got going for them is a bit later last season, they were starting to reach their peak under Glasner about March time. And now I think they've reached that a bit earlier. And if they can kind of maintain this momentum now and keep pushing and keep building on these performances, because their last two performances have been absolutely astounding, some of the attacking football they played, I do think there's a chance. I think maybe their best route to European success would be in the FA Cup, but I wouldn't rule it out in the Premier League completely. It's 6 points outside the top half, seven from Europe, some big games to come. Away from home, the fixtures get more difficult. You've got to play a lot of the big six, quote unquote, if we're still using that term. But yeah, there's every chance. I think the international break probably comes at the wrong time for Palace. The blank game week probably comes at the wrong time for Palace. So trip to Marbella the week beginning the 10th of March and then straight into the international break. And this is the point of the season where Palace are really starting to show the best sides of themselves. So in that sense, that's disappointing. And moving on to Will Hughes, it will be a miss. He's been one of Palace's most influential players this season. He's massively stepped up to fill the void of Adam Wharton when he's been injured. But I don't think it's as devastating as it probably would have been 6 weeks ago, because you've got Jefferson Lerma who can play in the six, and you've got Adam Wharton who can play in the eight. If things get really bad, you've got Chris Richards who can step in, you've got Justin Devenny, you've got Dutch Kamada. There's options there. And I think now Palace are starting to get into a point of where they've got almost all of their squad fit, barring Sheik Doucouré and Chadi Riyad. They look a real cohesive unit now, which we probably didn't have 6 or 7 weeks ago.
Yeah, obviously, very, very good performance from Adam Wharton involved in the three goals that occurred whilst he was on the pitch. I'm curious, Pat, what does he actually bring that is different from what we've been lining up with in his absence?
He brings just a deep lying playmaker, line breaking passes. He led the squad in progressive passes for the second match in a row, which is crazy because in the first match with Fulham, he only played half and he still led the squad in progressive passes. He was second only to Eze in shot creating actions, and he really wasn't getting that far forward. So those shot creating actions were genuinely off of deep progressive balls. In North America, we jokingly call this term a hockey assist, because in hockey, in the NHL here, they give an assist to the pass before the goal and also the pass before that pass. So two passes before the goal are chalked as an assist. If you look at all three goals where Adam Wharton was on the pitch, he had the hockey assist for all three of those. And I'm using a little bit of liberty for the first goal because there was an Emi Martinez save from Chris Richards in between Richards and Sarr knocking that ball in. But Wharton still played that cross. On the second goal, you look at Eze. He just fed him a beautiful ball, and Eze had the wherewithal, knowing that he was about to fall down, to just play a beautiful one-touch pass to Mateta, and he absolutely got his foot through that ball. What a shot that was with his weaker left foot. And the last one, with just playing a nice, simple through ball in the front on the feet of Munoz, just to come on and play a beautiful curling cross right into Sarr for the birthday boy's second goal of the night. He just offers this calmness on the ball and this ability to get the ball to our playmakers and let them create. And that's something that we've been surely missing for a long time.
Yeah, Mateta said in his post-match interview with Adam Wharton that, like, with Wharton on the pitch, he thinks he can score as much as he wants. And with the way our attack's clicking with him back, you can really sense how true that is. Ismaila Sarr, birthday boy, getting two goals, Mateta scoring. Eze, despite not getting his name on the score sheet, has looked so much better these last couple games. I know that started in a half that Wharton didn't play in. But yesterday, I've seen Eze kind of going under the radar just because of how good the other two were up top. But he's taking players on again. He was involved in that first goal. And yeah, his touch let him down at times, but his flicks and vision and passes could have gotten him an assist for Sarr in the first half. And for it set up Daichi Kamada for the pass to Mitchell, which then set up Nketiah's goal. And then, of course, Eddie Nketiah scoring his first goal for Crystal Palace. Bobby, it's been a long time coming.
Yeah, a long time coming, and that sentiment was oh my God, why have I gone blank? It has been a long time coming, and that was a sentiment echoed by Adam Wharton when I spoke to him after the game on Tuesday night. Said about how hard he's been working in training and that he's deserved the moment more than anyone. He's been super frustrated with his lack of minutes since joining the club, but it was a great moment for him, and to see the players gather around him in the way they did, it was a nice sight. The finish, it was a real poacher's finish. Some would say it was a tap-in, but he read the play well. He ran to the back post. He put it in the back of the net. And that's everything you want to see from a striker who likes being in and around the box. So it was really good from Eddie Nketiah.
It's a fantastic reminder of why I think a lot of us support this club, and what we love about this club is the genuine excitement and the genuine elation that the players had, that the crowd had, the supporters had for Nketiah scoring that goal. Just a great thing to see, and you can only hope that that's the kind of that moment where the confidence comes for it, and he can start coming off the bench and providing a nice little attacking option for us. But just love to see that. It's one of the reasons that I love Palace so much, is seeing how excited we genuinely were for our players.
And it was good to see Jean-Philippe Mateta rally around him as well when he scored, because let's not forget, Jean-Philippe Mateta was a striker who struggled for goals himself just, 18 months ago? So he understands what Eddie Nketiah has been through. He understands what it's like to be second choice when it was Odson Edouard starting for Crystal Palace. And that was good to see. And it was really nice to, I think it showed the real bond between the squad. And even though Eddie Nketiah has not had the opportunities we want this season, the elation he felt to score that goal, it shows that he's buying into what's going on at Palace. And hopefully he can start to pick up his career here in South London. And I think he will start to see more opportunities. Obviously, as we've discussed at length before, the system doesn't really suit him. He's more of a striker who plays in a two. He's not a 10, so there's no room for him there. But if he can give 15 minutes off the bench every week, chime in with a goal here and there, as he did against Arsenal in the Carabao Cup, as he did against QPR in the Carabao Cup, and now as he's done in the Premier League, his career at Crystal Palace will steadily start to improve, and I'm sure he will endear himself to the Selhurst Park crowd.
For £30 million, you certainly hope so. Maybe that's the cynic in me. But I also want to give a shout out to Tyrick Mitchell for his work in the build up for that goal. He's been practicing that cross every single game in the warm up. He's the last player to stay out before they go in for the sort of pre match talk. And he's trying those drilled crosses across the 6 yard box. And it was just a perfect ball. Puts it on a plate for Nketiah.
I think I'm one of Tyrick Mitchell's harshest critics at times. I think I've been really strong in the past with my analysis towards him. But I think that comes from a place of knowing how good of a player he can be, how good of a defensive player he is, and maybe how you want to see him just improve that attacking output. And everything he did against Fulham and everything he did against Aston Villa showed you that there is that attacking player in there with him. He made mistakes against Everton. He rectified those in these two games. I think he was superb in both games. The cross for the goal was exceptional. He done really well, really good work from him. Simple but effective cross to the back post. Puts it on a plate for Nketiah, and it was really good work from Ty. I think having the competition there now with Ben Chilwell will only elevate his performances. Yes, as I already mentioned, he crumbled against Everton, but he's very quickly improved that, and I'm very pleased for him.
I think that's another place where Adam Wharton can really help as well. We've talked about how Mitchell's been excellent defensively, and you know, better in the attacking third than I think most will give him credit for. Not great, but certainly not terrible. He has a lot of assists. He has a lot of expected assists, a lot of key passes, but he's not good at progressing the ball through the middle part of the pitch. And with Wharton back, we don't need Mitchell to do that. We have Wharton being able to play those passes and get it into the final third, where we can let Mitchell focus on his strengths, and that in turn is going to lead to better performances from him. So cannot understate how important it is to have that midfielder back for us. He's just a sensational player, and he's going to make everyone around him better.
And of course, Thomas Tuchel was in attendance at Selhurst Park on Tuesday night as well. I think as many as 10 England players were on the pitch. Four for Crystal Palace, or four who have been in squads recently. Dean Henderson, Ebra Chiesa, Mark Gay and Adam Wharton. I mean, what a performance for Adam Wharton to put on for Thomas Tuchel. He's got two games now to prove to Tuchel that he should be in the next England squad. And I tell you what, I don't think he'll be far away. Yes, he's not been back very long from injury, but if he puts in two more performances like that, he might force Thomas Tuchel's hand. England are short of a midfielder. It's Declan Rice, and the place next to him is up for grabs. You've got Angel Gomez, you've got Curtis Jones, a couple of others who could fit in there as well. Maybe Jude Bellingham might play that role, but I think it's actually suited to Adam Wharton more than anyone. He's that progressive ball carrier, very, very incisive with his passing, and can break up players well. And I think he'll complement Declan Rice very well. So that place up for grabs for Adam Wharton. I don't think we'll see Ebra Chiesa in the squad, just because there are such a vast array of attacking talent available to Thomas Tuchel. I think he just falls below the options he's got, whether that's Jude Bellingham, Cole Palmer. Obviously, Saka's injured for this international break, but he'll be in conversations in the future. So I'd be surprised if we see a recall for Ebra Chiesa. I just think he's a cut below the players that England have got at their selection. Dean Henderson, now number two, certainly. I think he's got a good chance of becoming England number one. Jordan Pickford hasn't really done anything wrong for England. But I just think that Dean Henderson is probably the better keeper. He's a bit younger than Pickford. So if you have eyes to the future, maybe it's time now for a new England shot stopper. I think he's been probably one of the best goalkeepers in the league this season. Palace would have taken a lot longer to get a win on the board if it wasn't for Dean Henderson, that's for sure. And Mark Gave, probably England's first choice centre back now. So it's some really good attack, really good English talent on show at Selhurst Park. And I'm sure Thomas Tuchel was very pleased with what he saw.
I am baffled why I keep seeing people making England squads without Mark Gahey in them.
I wrote in a piece of Arbat, I think he's a candidate to be a future England captain. I think he's a leader. I think he's confident on the ball. I think he's confident in his communication. And I think he's a superb defender. He's the full package. He was the best player for England in the European Championship. Maybe one mistake he made that led to a goal. And obviously the suspension he had, which wasn't even his fault because player put him in a difficult situation. He was forced to make a foul for his second yellow card of the tournament. But I just think that he is England's number one centre-back. I don't even think it's up for debate. Anyone I talk to in the industry who covers England has a similar opinion. I think it's a very easy decision for Thomas Tuchel. The question is, who will partner him?
Well, I'll use you mentioning Tuchel as an opportunity for a little segue, which is to talk about the sheer quality of the managers we had at Selhurst Park last night. But the best, of course, our very own Oliver Glasner, who completely tactically outclassed Unai Emery. Pat, just walk us through it, because it was a beautiful thing to watch.
It was, and it's a joy to see two Europa League winning managers play at Selhurst Park. I don't know if we've ever had that before. Actually, I know we haven't had that before. And that's the last time Villa showed up to play at Selhurst. But yeah, historically, I mean, in four matches against Emery's Villa, Palace have won three and drawn one, with a goals forced of 13 and a goals allowed of 4. So they have not really been that close. In order to kind of talk about what Glasner did, it's important to note what he's been doing or what Palace have been doing this year. There's a nifty little statistic called passes per defensive action. We call it PPDA for short. Basically, it is a measure of how passive or how aggressive a defense is. And it's important to note that when I say passive, I don't mean lackadaisical or aloof. I just mean how likely are they to engage or try to close down the ball. So what it measures is the average amount of passes that the team in possession takes before the defense attempts a tackle or attempts an interception or does some kind of defensive action, commits a foul, et cetera, et cetera. On the season, Palace's average is 12.1, which is 14th in the Premier League. So they're the 14th most passive defense, if you will. Again, not saying that they're out of sorts, just they're very organized, but they're just not being aggressive in closing people down. And we've been playing this lower block passively, picking our moments to win the ball back and attack in these big spaces behind the opposing back line. And we're seeing those counterattacking style goals. We've noted that Jean-Philippe Mateta is second only to Ollie Watkins in runs in behind the back line and through balls. So it's something that we've had a lot of success with. In this match, we didn't play a low block as much. We played a mid block, and we're insanely more aggressive. Our passes per defensive action was 6.9, so we nearly halved what is our season average. We were very aggressive in closing down players. We weren't giving Villa much time on the ball, and one could surmise that the reason behind that is because Emery's teams are very comfortable in playing that methodical, meticulous, slow possession base. They take their time. They don't enjoy playing in the counter. I think they've only scored one or zero goals on a counterattack all season. So by us kind of being a little more aggressive in that mid block, we were able to close them down and still create space in behind. You know, a high press would be a little bit deviating too far from what we've been known to do this season, because it would leave us a little bit exposed behind and not in a situation we're comfortable with. And it also doesn't give us that space behind the back line. So that mid block, I think, was a perfect genius display by Glasner. And it shows in the goals. And not only are these goals fantastic, but you could really make the argument that we should have had more. And I say that because if we look at the underlying data, the XG of these will all be non-penalty XG or NPXG because there were no penalties. Generally speaking, when you had these high scoring affairs, you are overperforming on XG because the amount of clinician that is happening on the pitch is just so high. And that's why you're seeing these goals go in. Case in point, last spring, when we scored 5 against Villa, 5 against West Ham, 4 against Man United, we actually doubled our XG output from those matches because we were just insanely clinical. We underperformed our XG in this match, which is insane. 4.3 non-penalty XG. That is the 5th highest total in the Premier League this season. It is the highest generated MPXG for Crystal Palace since they've joined the Premier League in 2013-14. And the non-penalty expected goal difference, which also highlights the amount of chances we conceded or lack thereof, was 3.9, which again, 3rd highest in the Premier League this season and the highest that Crystal Palace has had in this Premier League run. So we probably could have scored more, and that's insane to say when we're talking about a dominant 4-1 victory.
I think I totally agree with you. Tyrick Mitchell, if you think back to his chance, he could have scored. There was a few more opportunities as well. I think Villa went very gung-ho 2-1, and I just think it made very easy for Palace to counter-attack. They were constantly on their back three. I think it was poor from Unai Emery. I think he just got completely out-coached by Oliver Glasner. 4-1, maybe flatter Villa in the end, actually, because Palace had chances to make it 5-6 and maybe even 7. I just thought it was a brilliant performance. Sarr was absolutely superb. Eze was brilliant. Mateta was clinical again. What a finish. Great strike. And it was really good work from Adam Walter. I just think it was an absolutely complete performance. It was the same word I used for the Fulham game, and it's the same word I used for Villa. Complete. It was the perfect way to brush aside the whole conversation about Palace aren't very good at home. They've been struggling at home, putting 4 past top 8 Champions League side, Aston Villa. It's just rubbished any theory anyone had about why Palace were poor at home. And Glasner said in the press conference after the game that he's pleased that he's not got to answer questions on the home form anymore.
Last season, we had something similar, and Glasner's talked about it, how important it is to build that foundation and how the performances, good performances are going to come before good results do. And we saw that for really February and March of last year until we went up to Anfield and put together that performance against Liverpool that really kind of kickstarted that wonderful spring that we had to end our season. And the same thing was here. The underlying data was always there at home. It was really negligible, the difference between our away form and our home form in terms of performance, in terms of the underlying data and all of that. The results just weren't coming. So it's something that I've referred to as the tipping point before, and I'll use it again. I think this was a tipping point moment for us to kind of get that monkey off our back in terms of our home form and start to play with a little bit more freedom and a little bit less pressure.
One thing I felt was really bizarre in the game was Unai Emery changing formation. I think it just kind of played straight into Palace hands. Like you were trying to beat Palace at their own game. It was never really going to work. And at halftime, when he brought Leon Bailey on, my instant thought was, oh, Conte will go to right back, Digne will stay at left back, and they'll go back to a typical back four. But they stuck with the back five, and it just left them so open when they were pushing for that game at 2-1. It was a really messy and disorganised second half for Aston Villa, and it was just very, very simple for Palace to comfortably win.
It was a clinical attacking performance against Aston Villa and against Fulham. And yet, it was such a strong performance that we didn't see any cries from fans, really, to bring on Romain Eze, who obviously we signed for 15-odd million on a 5.5-year contract. It's a testament to how well we've been playing, but there's got to be a few questions about why he's not getting the game time. Bobby, can you enlighten us as to why that could be?
Yeah, I quizzed Oliver Glasner on this on Monday before the Aston Villa game. Essentially the answer he gave back to me was that he wants Romain Eze to remain patient, the right opportunity to integrate him into games haven't really risen yet. He pointed to the Fulham game, talking about having to think whether he needs a dribbler, someone who can keep possession, someone tactically on top level, or someone with more pace. Obviously you'd expect Eze to be that man with more pace, but 2-0 up at Craven Cottage, you deemed that he needed those players who keep possession. So the technical players of Justin Deveni and Daichi Kamada were favoured over Romain Eze. I get the sense that maybe Glasner doesn't fully trust him yet. I think obviously the comments he come out with is what you would expect from a manager to protect his player, but I just get the sense he doesn't trust him yet. You think the Doncaster game would have been that perfect game to integrate him, yet Justin Devenny was preferred in the 10 when Esse is the real flair player, the man who can beat a player, which Justin Devenny hasn't really got that ability about him. So I think it's just going to be about time of proving himself in training to Oliver Glasner, getting minutes here and there. Maybe the right games haven't come up yet. I do think that's probably fair. But there was nothing stopping him coming on for the final 10 minutes with Eddie Nketiah against Aston Villa when the game was dead and buried, yet Oliver Glasner opted to keep him on the bench. So for me, it's just that he needs to earn the trust of his manager. Maybe we'll see him in the FA Cup against his former side, Millwall. It seems like a logical time for him to get some substantial minutes, probably not from the start because Palace will go full strength, you would expect. But maybe, you know, 20 minutes if things are going really well.
Yeah, I think it's a good problem to have. You know, if you look at if the inverse of this was true and Palace were struggling and we were really needing SA to come on and be a savior for us, I think that puts a lot of unwarranted pressure on a young player. You know, having our attackers play so well, and when in the January window we were crying out for somebody on the right hand side to be able to take a player on and to make attacking runs and all of this, and I don't know how many would have seen Ismaïla Sarr being able to kind of comfortably shift in and play in that half space as he has, and Daniel Munoz really to kind of become our auxiliary winger and do all the things that we were hoping that a right-sided attacker could do. So yeah, I think he has to be patient, and I think he has a good support system around him that's going to keep him level-headed. And you talk any of the quotes that SA has said, he seems like he really has a good head on his shoulders for a young player. But I think it's a good problem that he's not being forced to come in and try and save this club for us right now.
I guess it leaves the question, though. Do you think we'll see him get a start against Millwall on Saturday, obviously his former club?
No. I think the answer is a straight no for me. It's going to be Sarr and Eze, you would expect. I'll be full strength, I think. Maybe Matt Turner in goal over Dean Henderson. He's kind of been the cup goalkeeper. Potentially a different centre-back if Mark Gay is not fit. He struggled with his knee against Aston Villa, so maybe he might need to be rested, but we will see.
So my question would be, and I'll pose this to you guys, if we are expecting Lerma to play in that midfield role, but Gahee can't go, I would assume that we would see Gahee in the back three and possibly Kamada in next to Warren. Is that how you would foresee it if Gahee can't go? Or could you see Nathaniel Klein possibly coming in for a cameo and that hasn't happened in quite some time?
I think if there's no Gahee, it'll just be Lerma playing a centre-back with Hughes and Wharton in midfield. And I think if Gahee is available, then it will be either a Hughes-Wharton midfield or a Lerma-Wharton midfield.
You don't think we'll see Joel Ward?
No, I think he's still injured.
Oh, unfortunate. Oh, man. Well,
as I said, it would be 2 to 3 weeks until he could have full training again.
Oh, shame. I would have loved to see Joel Ward play against Millwall. You know what? I'll take Nathaniel Klein nonetheless, because just to have him be on there while we sing South London Is Ours a good, you know, 12 years after the original tweet.
What a tweet.
Oh, man. Just do.
I think, as I say, I think Palace will be as full strength as they possibly can be. It's a chance to get in the quarterfinals of the FA Cup against probably their biggest rivals. Some would say Brighton. Personally, I would fall on the Millwall side as being bigger rivals, the local derby, if you like. Fierce game. As everyone remembers, the last time in the FA Cup under Patrick Vieira, the 2-1 win on the road to Wembley. I just think it's a massive game. It's Palace's best chance of success this season. A lot of big teams are already out of the FA Cup. Probably the two Manchester teams and Newcastle, the biggest sides left. Millwall provided that direct threat. They'll be disciplined. They like a long ball, which Palace have struggled against at times this season. It will be a tough game. It's not going to be easy, but I'm certainly looking forward to it. Millwall boss Alex Neil was at Selhurst on Tuesday, and that game probably struck the fear of God into him. Michael Oliver to referee. It's a huge affair, and it's going to be a really entertaining game on Saturday.
I'm honestly so nervy about it, just because I remember last time we played Millwall, they gave us a good run for our money until we let Michael Olise loose on them. And I know last time we were in this position in the FA Cup, we struggled to get a win against Stoke. Thankfully, we have a lot more quality on our side now.
Was it Jairo Riedewald who scored?
Jairo Riedewald who scored, and then Oh God, I don't know who scored the first one. Was it Kiate? It was
This
like,
one.
it was a weird, weird game. I know Teo Adremola started and did quite well. I think that's a sole start for us, actually. Ah, oh, Teo. But yeah, must win. If we're through, we're into what, the quarterfinals, and then, you're a game away from Wembley. Whether you agree with that or not, for the semi-finals. But God, if we were to miss out on Europe, miss out on Europe, can I, you believe I'm saying that, in the league, God knows it'd be made easier if we managed to do something special in the cup.
I think Palace will be there or thereabouts in the FA Cup. Look, if you look at this Millwall game neutrally and not with a Palace hat on, you would expect Palace to get past them. But it's never that simple, especially in a derby game where Millwall have got nothing to lose. It's probably their cup final. And it's just going to be a really entertaining game of football. I'm for one, I'm really looking forward to it. Nice to have a South London derby at Selhurst Park. It will be a busy Saturday afternoon for me, but I'm very much looking forward to the game.
I'm so excited to be sitting right in the Arthur Waite next to those Millwall
Stay safe.
fans.
Wear a hard hat.
12:15 kickoff. I'll be fine. Oh man. Well, look, it's been lovely chatting to you lads. I think that's about all we've got time for today. I can only hope our mood is good for the post Millwall pod, where we'll hopefully have Ollie Thomas from Talk CPFC joining us. Stay tuned for what comes next, but for now, that's all from us. Be sure to follow the Palace Way on socials if you're not already at the Palace Way. Give Bobby Manzi a follow on Twitter at Bobby Manzi, and Pat, which is what's your tag on Blue Sky now, Pat?
I don't even know. Just search for Tampa Palace, you'll find me.
Yeah, Tampa Palace, you'll find it. That's all from us. Thanks for listening. Bye.